Shavua Tov, everybody. Top of the week. Although if we were in Israel, this is Yom Sheni. We'd ready to be off and running. Okay, hope everybody had a nice Shabbos. Hope you had a nice Sunday. I hope you're enjoying a little bit of the weather, although it's a little gray. We can bring some brightness, some sunshine to our Monday morning. Okay, good. So let's just get started. First and foremost, this class this year, this morning, Contemporary Cases and Shas, is generously sponsored by our dear friends, Dr. David and Smadar Seinfeld. Thank you so much for sponsoring this Torah class to commemorate the yahrzeit of your beloved father, Isaac Seinfeld, Yitzchak Ben Yaakov. His neshama should have an aliyah. It should be a merit for his soul and a schus for your entire family. Thank you so much for your generosity. And let's look forward to learning here together. Okay, so we have an interesting case, another one of our fascinating cases here to study. Part of what's an introduction to this case that we're going to go through now is something that I think is a problem that I call an unspoken problem in many shuls, in many communities. And the unspoken problem is that sometimes you have situations where people ascend to daven for the amud. We've spoken about this a little bit in the past, in different circumstance, different type of case, where a person ascends the pulpit or ascends the amud rather, and that person is going to lead the services, lead the congregation, but they're not so comfortable in the language. They don't daven with the right words. They aren't comfortable with Hebrew. They aren't uncomfortable with the Aramaic, whether it's saying the Kaddish. And the question that becomes is, if it is what we say is ma'akev, ma'akev means, should that person not be allowed to lead the prayer services? At what point do you correct that person? Now, we know that we're very, very exceedingly scrupulous when it comes to correcting a Baal Koreh, right? David, I'm sure you know that I can't imagine you've been corrected much because you work with precision, but you know the idea of like how people are. I remember the Rav of our shul used to always make announcements like there's a limit to how many people are allowed to correct. There was like a battle between the correctors, right? This one thought it was this one thought it was that. Often we make that announcement when we have a bar mitzvah in shul. You know, I try to tell people like everyone should like be kind and generous and let it just be that the bar mitzvah teacher or the rabbi, whoever it should make the corrections. We're very careful, very conscious about the correct reading of words. It's zecher, it's zochar, it's zecher, it's ace, it's es, it's right. We're very careful because this is a mitzvah that's chal on the tzibar, the congregation. I want to be sure to it that we hear every single word. It's also, we just had reading the Megillah. One of the challenges that we had with the acoustics and the air conditioning and the social distancing and the space and everything is, you know, you have to hear every single word of the Megillah. What happens if you can't hear every word? Have you not fulfilled your obligation? You have to be mashlam, you yourself have to say the words that you've missed, which is why some people are accustomed, you know, there's a mitzvah to read what we call Shnai Mikra Ve'echa Targum. What's Shnai Mikra Ve'echa Targum? You have to go through the weekly sedra, the weekly portion, two times with its regular reading in the Hebrew. And Echa Targum means with one Targum translation. Now, it's a discussion, what is the Targum translation? Is it reading Rashi? Is it reading the Targum Unklis? Is it reading any commentary? Is it just reading it in English today? It's not a topic for right now, but it's interesting conversation. The fulfillment of Shnai Mikra Ve'echa Targum has to be fulfilled each week with the weekly Parsha. Now, one of the ways that we do that, Rav Moshe writes, that you can actually read with the Baal Koreh. So let's say I'm standing in my seat, the Baal Koreh is laying the Parsha. So as long as I read along with that Baal Koreh, what with the reading while it's taking place, I say it in undertone, right? So then I am laning it like he's laning it. So then I'm able to have that count as echad, one of the Shnai Mikra, one of the two times I'm obligated to read it. Now, the problem is sometimes you have people that they're doing it at their seat too loud. And then you're like, I'm trying to listen to the main guy, buddy, like slow down, calm down, pipe it down, lower the volume. So that's always become a fun little issue. You know, sometimes I feel like we complicate matters so much unnecessarily, you know, you're trying to even do good things. Anyway, but that's the way you can do it. The reason we're very careful, you want to make sure that A, you fulfill Shnai Mikra Ve'echa Targum, but also you want to make sure that you're listening to every single word. What happens if you miss a word? As we don't hear every word. What happens if you don't have the right word in davening? What if the chazan doesn't say the right word? Or what if a person, and we'll get to our case now, what happens if a person is in a compromised situation where they can't enunciate the words the way they're supposed to, and maybe they were once able to, or maybe they know the way they're supposed to be said, but they're not able to do it anymore. They stop saying brachas, they stop davening? Of course not. So what's the halacha, what's the case in a situation where there's a compromise or there's an inadequacy or there's an inaccuracy as it relates to davening or saying brachos? Now, this case is unique because it's talking about a single person, what their situation is. But obviously this dovetails into whenever you're saying something on behalf of others, the correctness that's critical, that's obvious, and that's necessary when you call to compromise because you're not saying the words correctly, how often and how accurately do that those person have to be? Now, I try very carefully to make sure that the people, you know, it's obviously not possible to always get it right, but the people that are davening for the Amid, that they are saying the words correctly. In fact, we've invested time, resources to be sure to it that the people who are davening for the Amid know how to daven, get sometimes even tutored to know the words that they're saying have to be said correctly. Just because a person, for example, is an avil, is a mourner, doesn't mean that they have, you know, the skills of being able to lead the services, even though it's a big schus, it's a big merit to do so. If you know how to do it, then good. If a person doesn't know how to do it, it might be a bigger schus for that person not to do it than to actually go ahead and to do it. But we can get to that in a little bit. Okay, so listen to this interesting case. It's Simon Lamed Gimel, chapter 33. And this is talking about a person who is a chola, a person who is sick. Now, what happens? What's that mean? That person is sick, and because of his illness, says Megam Game, he is, how do I translate Megam Game, Doc? Confused? Disoriented?
Stutter,
yes, thank you. Stutters, good. And a medallic tavos, and he omits a letter or omits a word. He makes some type of error. Whether his davening is correct, whether he's in fulfillment of the mitzvah. So listen to this case, and there's just an unbelievable answer here, and we'll see how this can be applied in other areas as well. Cholish biglal machaloso, this ill person because of his illness, medallic tavos shlemos mibrachos. He recites blessings, but those blessings are incomplete. He leaves out words or he leaves out letters. I think I've mentioned this before. I have a family member, a little bit of a distant family member. Let's call it a second cousin 15 times removed just for the purpose of this Torah lecture, is that when he says a blessing, he says, Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu melech ha'olam. It doesn't say melech ha'olam. There's a lot of commentary in the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishneh Berurah about what happens if you omit an essential word. What happens if you omit a word? What happens if you omit an essential word? The essential word is melech. It doesn't say melech, it says mela, like watermelon, like mela ha'olam. So what's the case then? Does that create a situation where it's ma'akev and you're not fulfill your obligation? The answer is it does. So here, this is the case. This fellow's ill for whatever the reason. He's not able to say the complete word, the complete sentence of that bracha. V'gam, minusach ha'tfila, and also the language of the tefillah, mitchilas habracha umisofa, from the beginning of the blessing to the end of the blessing. And the question is, ha'im yesh b'zeh mishum mishana matbeya shetavu chachamim. Now that's just a statement. That's just a phrase that is used, that mishana matbeya, what's matbeya? Like the coin shetavu chachamim. You don't want to indicate a change, a distinction from that greatness that the Chachamim, when they established, A, through the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the organized tefillah, the words that we're supposed to say, certainly you're allowed to add tefillos and personal supplications to your davening, but to change the words we don't do. We don't change the words. So that's what he's referring to. Or is this, would it be that in a situation where he's lost a word, he can't complete the sentence, he misses a pronunciation, is he mishana matbea shetavu chachamim? Has he changed the ways of the chachamim? B'chosav levatola, and thus it would be a blessing in vain. Is it a bracha levatola? Ve'en levarachima, and you can't bless with him. You can't hear a bracha from him. So in the case of a shlich tzibor, that person should be yanked. Or in a case of even being motze another person for a bracha, you come to my house for a Shabbos meal, and I say, Baruch atah Hashem ha-motzi lecha min ha-aretz. I didn't say those words in full. I didn't say melech ha'olam. So now I can't fulfill my obligation through my saying it. You can't fulfill your obligation through my saying it. So what's the halacha? What's the din? Is it a case of mishana matbea shetavu chachamim birchaso levatala? It's a very strong statement. Is blessings in vain? Or is there something to be said for what he's thinking about, what he thinks, what he hopes, what he knows to be correct? And there might be circumstances of leniency. And certainly when you talk about a situation where it's b'makom she'enish, you don't have that many choices. Let's say the bench isn't so deep. How many people really know how to daven for the omid? Maybe it's better. It's an eis lasos heferu teresech, which means it's a time of extraordinary pressing circumstance and consequence. And therefore, maybe there's a leniency. Okay, so that's the case. And obviously, there's so many different adaptations as we just in our introduction are sharing. Let's go through this response. Here we go together. said Nira. He said, it appears to me, Nira, she'adif she'yishma ha'brachos v'hatfilos me'acher. It seems to me that if a person has a chayla, a person has an illness, a person has a sickness, a person has some type of difficulty, so it's always better in a situation where you're going to compromise the fullness of the recitation of that bracha. He says, it seems that it's adif, it's preferred, it's ideal for a person to hear the bracha or tefillah from somebody else. Now that's introducing also a very well-known sugya and Maseches Brachos, the concept of Shomea Ka'ona. What's Shomea Ka'ona mean? Anybody know? What's Shomea Ka'ona? That listening to it, hearing it, is as if you're answering it. And that is a very, very important principle because it has also a lot of different components of it. So for example, if let's just say I hear somebody say something, you make a bracha, you hear a blessing from somebody, and I don't necessarily answer it. Now, the reason why I don't answer that bracha by saying amen is a circumstance that I'm in. What's the circumstance? What's a classic example of a circumstance that I'm in that I can't answer that bracha? Anybody know? So let's just say you're in the middle of Shemoneh Esrei. You're davening a longer Shemoneh Esrei. And for whatever the reason, the chazan starts Chazar Sashatz already before you're finished. So in order for you to fulfill the obligation that's necessary of Chazar Sashatz, which that's argued also Machlokes in the Rishonim of the Gemara, do I need Chazar Sashatz? I don't need Chazar Sashatz. I just need my own tefillah. That's tefillah b'tzibur. As long as I have a tefillah with the congregation, that's fine. Do I need Chazar Sashatz? I don't need Chazar Sashatz. It's a takanas rabbanon. It's a rabbinic ordinance that, of course, we do it and we say Baruch Baruch Shemo and Amen. But what happens if there's a part of the davening that I can't answer because I'm in the middle of my Shemoneh Esrei? So what's the halacha? What do you do? Do you keep davening or do you stop? So the answer is you stop, you pause. You don't stop your Shemoneh Esrei. You're not oikar raglav. You don't take three steps back. What you do is you're silent and you're listening, and your shomea is ka'ona. You're listening to it, an attentive listening to it, I should say, is ka'ona. It's as if you've answered it. And so therefore you fulfilled whatever you needed to fulfill because of an inability to actually respond. Now there are those who actually have an even more lenient opinion. And Shomea Ka'ona can mean just even in a case where I'm not in a situation where I'm compromised because I'm in the middle of my Shemoneh Esrei and I can't otherwise pause, I can't break up my Shemoneh Esrei. As long as I listen, I'm Ka'ona. One of the examples that's given is Kriyas HaTorah. I don't, even though that's an obligation on the congregation, as long as I'm listening attentively, I can fulfill my obligation because of Shomea Ka'ona. I can listen to somebody's tefillah. Person can make a bracha for me, and I can have in mind that I'm going to fulfill my obligation through your saying of that bracha, and that's Shomea is Ka'ona, okay? Has a lot of different parts of it. And one of the biggest errors that I think a lot of people make, and now maybe you'll be more aware of it when you go either to shul, our shul, sometimes you hear it, or even other shuls when you travel, is you ever hear the chazan who's saying the Shemoneh Esrei and Chazar Sashatz. So sometimes I find when they do the Kedusha, you ever find? So really when they say Kedusha, what's the Chazan supposed to say? Nikadesh as Shimcha, right? They're supposed to start from the beginning. Nikadesh Shimcha from the beginning. Nikadesh as Shimcha. And then conclude with Vikara Ze El Ze Vi Omar, right? That's how it ends, that first paragraph. So sometimes what happens is I see either the Chazan's either in a little bit of a rush or he doesn't know this halacha. He just says, Vikara Ze El Ze Vi Omar, right? He just says the last part of it. It doesn't say the whole thing, right? And that's really because he thinks, just like in Psukei Dezimra, if I'm leading the congregation Psukei Dezimra, all I have to say is Tehilas Hashem Yidaber Pi V'Yivarech, etc. Just say that last paragraph, and that's really the end. I don't really have to say that out loud, but I only say that out loud, says the Shulchan Aruch, to indicate that the next paragraph is to be said. Right? I'm just trying to keep pace. I'm trying to keep everybody on the same page and at the same rhythm, because the whole goal of Tefillah B'Tzibur is to be able to daven Shemoneh Esrei together. Right? So I have to keep people on pace. I don't have to say those last paragraphs out loud. I do, to keep everybody on the same page. In fact, there are some shuls and some yeshivas, they don't do that. They just pick up from Yishtabach. They're all saying Psukei Dezimra themselves. Okay, you'll hear the sound of kol tefillah, but they're not going to say the ending sentence of every one of the paragraphs of Tehillim of Psukei Dezimra, because they just don't think they have to, which they don't technically. We do, many shuls do, most shuls do, because it keeps people on pace. So because of the fact that we have systems that are set to think that we don't need to recite the whole thing for us to be Yotze, that's true in most situations, but that's certainly not true in the case of Kedusha. So when the Chazan says, right? Starts it, but he doesn't, or if he starts from the beginning and he concludes with Vikar Zel Zevi Omar, that's correct. But if the Chazan only says Vikar Zel Zevi Omar, so then that's incorrect, because I will have missed that part of listening to the first section of that first paragraph of the Kedusha. I have to hear that. So you have to go over to the Chazan and say, you know, when you say Chazar Sashat, you have to say the whole thing. You can't just say the last part. You have to say the entire thing, because it's a incomplete and a lacking of the fullness of the whole tefillah. And I, who either am saying Shemoneh Esrei and can't respond, or even if I can respond, but I'm not hearing the whole thing, it's a diminishment in the fulfillment of the concept of Shomea Ka'ona. I have to hear it. And being able to hear it, I can have the measurement of which I am credited as if I have answered it as well. Okay? That's the concept of Shmei Kohenis. In this first case is Nirish Adiv Sheishma Brachos Me'atfilos. It's better for a person to eat, sorry, to eat, to hear Brachos and Tfilos from somebody else. A person will fulfill his obligation. Midin Shmei Kohenis. You'll fulfill your obligation, whatever that obligation is, through Shomea Ka'ona. Now, obviously, we know that there are certain mitzvot, certain brachos, that it is permissible for a person to make a bracha many times, even though I fulfilled my own obligation. And then there are others that you can't. What's the example of the one that you can? Many that you can. So, for example, if I say I made Kiddush Friday night or Shabbos day, so I know that even though I made Kiddush and fulfilled my obligation, you did not yet hear Kiddush, you did not make Kiddush yet, so I'm allowed to make Kiddush for you and for anybody for that matter, as many times as is necessary. That's fulfillment of Shomea Ka'ona. I have an obligation to help you fulfill your obligation. Now that seems to be contradictory. If I have my obligation fulfilled, why do I have to, you know, help you fulfill your obligation if you haven't done it yet? Not our topic, but the answer is, the simple answer is, Kol Yisrael Revim Zeb Zeb Mitzvos, Tigmar Maseches Erchin explains that we have an obligation to help other people fulfill their mitzvahs as best as they can. So there's a certain halachic dispensation to do so. And obviously the category of brachos, which brachos are birchas hanenin, birchas hamitzvos, you know, birchas shevach v'hodah, those categories of brachos also indicate whether and in which situations it is permissible, in which cases it is not. Okay, that's obviously sidetracking us a little bit. Any questions about Shomea Ka'on? I want to make sure we have that point clear. If not, please don't be shy. Okay, you know the concept of shtika kohida? You know what shtika kohida means? We have a little bit of shtika kohida here. That's nice. If you don't know what shtika kohida means, silence is an acceptance of understanding. So in that silence, I'll assume we understand the concept of shomei kohida. Good. Now v'efshar. Now what does it mean v'efshar? If it's v'efshar, means if it's not possible. Now we have in halacha many situations where it's efshar. One of the ways that we know that v'efshar means it's just not possible. So the first example is good. A person doesn't have the chalas, the ability to say the bracha himself correctly. So you know what they're going to do? They're going to find somebody else to say the bracha. Good, that's fine. But what if that's not possible? What if there's nobody else to do it? So then what do you do? That's where we're going to introduce these other sections of how to apply what the halacha is, but you have many cases where it's efshar. For example, efshar l'kayim shnehem. You're not able to do two things at the same time. You can't read two Torahs at the same time, right? With Parshas HaChodesh, this coming Shabbos, with Parshas Parah, last Shabbos, so you can't read two. It's efshar l'kayim shnehem. You can't read them both at the same time. B'vas achas, so you have to pick one. You can't put talis and tefillin on at the same time because you just can't. Sometimes you have situations where you just cannot do two mitzvos at the same time. So you have different applications. Tadu v'sheinu, tadu kodem. We know that which mitzvah is more frequent than one which is less frequent. Then we choose the one which is more frequent. That's, of course, why we put talis before tefillin. That's why we pick the weekly sedra versus the occasional sedra. But then there are other situations where it's because it's efshar, because it's not possible, it means you're putter from that mitzvah. I might just not be able to do it. So if it's not possible, it doesn't mean that you're derelict, you've lost an opportunity to do a mitzvah, just means it's not possible. So when it's not possible, so according to the poskim, you're potter. It's potter, it's exempt, and therefore it's kilu. It's almost as if it never happened. So in this case, v'im efshar, if it's not possible, what's the efshar going on? The efshar is going on. I don't have somebody else to say the bracha for me. So even b'shevet Levi. So the Shevet Levi writes in his commentary an interesting idea. Shekosav, he writes, v'zel shana. We'll understand this is the language. Kavan, this is just a fascinating tshuva here. Kavan shekavanasa letova, since his kavana, his intention is good. He's got good intentions, right? Which, how often in halacha do we have that this is such a concept? If I have good intentions, who says that good intentions is enough? So he says, this is the Shevet Levi, says, Kevin shekavanosa l'toiva l'ispalo k'halacha. This guy's intention, he doesn't want to daven irregularly. He doesn't want to daven irreverently. He wants to daven k'halacha. His intention is to daven k'halacha. But here's the problem. Because of his chayla, because of his illness, rak be'emtsa, in the middle of his davening, tafsu machlas hadiluk. You know what happens? Because of the illness that he's dealing with, so it's taifes machlas hadiluk, which means it just gets him, it grasps him, it overcomes him, it overtakes him. Now, that's the cause and the reason for his diluk, for his, you know, lacking the completion of either that sentence or of the word. Now, this is a chayla, a sickness. Obviously, one of the cases here is stutter. Or sometimes what happens is just pure sheer nerves. A person's just nervous. So the nervousness that a person feels, so like they don't plan on when they ascend the Amid. There are many times where I see people, they're very comfortable in the vernacular, talking in Hebrew and reading in Hebrew, and they learn perfectly fine. I don't know, but for some reason they stand in a pulpit, they stand in a bima, they stand as a shlich tzibur, they get all nervous, they get all sweaty. I mean, literally, there's somebody that I know is a massive Talmud Chacham. He simply cannot stand as a shlich tzibur. He just gets too nervous. He gets too anxious and doesn't know what to do. And what happens when he starts davening for the omelet? So then he starts making mistakes. So rak be'emsa tofsu machlas adilug. So then the illness, it overcomes him. Einu nichnas begeder moitzi shem shemayim levatolos. So he says, if this is the situation that happens, so since this is what happens, this doesn't count as a situation where it's moitzi shem shemayim levatolos. It's not that he now, you know, made a bracha levatola. It's just a different way of saying it. Motzei shem shemayim levatola. It's like a bracha levatola. Motzei shem shemayim levatola. It's not that he intended to do that. Now, it would obviously be a different situation if it was what we say in halacha is called a psik resha. Does anybody know what a psik resha is? Okay. Psik resha is, there's two different categories of psik resha. Psik resha is nichale and delo nichale. It's used in Hilchos Shabbos. And the laws of Shabbos. Psik resha literally means is if you chop off the head of the animal will die, right? It's the eventual cause that will happen as a result of whatever action you take. Now, the reason why we have to know what psik resha is, so for example, let's just imagine, is it permissible for you to walk into the lobby of a hotel? Let's say you're going somewhere for Pesach and you walk into the lobby of a hotel, and you know that if you walk past the electric doors of the hotel, the doors are going to open, right? So that is a psik resha. You know that if you walk past it, it's going to open. Or if you're walking home at night from shul, so you know that the lights that are on somebody's house, they're sensor lights, and they're going to be ignited, they're going to be lit, they're going to illuminate. So you're not allowed to, are you not allowed to walk in that spot? Since you know, psik resha, that it's no question about it. It's going to be that you're going to walk in that spot. It's going to create an illumination. Is it because of what you do that creates that Chilul Shabbos? Or let's just say security cameras. You have your security cameras on. So do you have to turn them off on Shabbos? Now, what happens if you turn them off on Shabbos? Then what kind of security is that? Do you have the halachic dispensation to allow them to stay on? So psik resha means, it's just a Talmud term for saying that you chop off the head, but the chop off the head will result, the animal's not going to survive. So if doing A causes B without exception, so then we say that it's not allowed, it's prohibited on Shabbos. Machlokes in the Gemara, and one of the categories where the machlokes is found is whether it's psik resha, that it's nichale or it's delo nichale. Nichale means that it's a benefit for you and it's not benefit. So for example, since we say, I'll give you, here's one category would be for benefit, one category would be for not benefit. So you know, so we have cameras in shul. Right? So we have cameras in shul, different places on the outside and the perimeter of the shul. So before we did the most recent upgrade, we actually had a camera. I don't know if you remember. I think it's actually still there. I have to remember when I walk back into the shul later today. It's not a hot camera, meaning it's not on, it's not connected to anything. But there's a camera that when you walk in the front door, you can see people that will come through the front door. Okay? Do you remember that camera? I don't know, whatever it is. There's a camera there. Okay, so once upon a time, it was active, it was connected. And at once upon a time, inside the shul office, there was a screen, a TV screen, and that screen would show all the cameras, like you would have at any in any business, you know, we have a security guard that's sitting at manning like the front station of the building area, and he's looking at all the screens, he's managing all the spots and the windows and the doorways and alleyways and entrances and exits and things of that sort, right? So it happens to be that you'd be able to see somebody comes in the shul. Obviously, you want to see who comes in. So one Shabbos, it happens. There were a bunch of kids. It's going back a few years ago now. There were a bunch of kids that they figured out that if they stand in front of the screen, they'll be able to, of the camera, they'll be able to go into the office and they'll be able to see themselves on TV. So they're able to get into the office because kids are kids, and there's that that little very easy access little window when you walk in, obviously. And one Shabbos, you know, late after davening, I see that there's like a whole circus going on. The kids are in there doing interviews, pretending like they're like on some news channel, and the kids are in the front waving, right? That's nichale. That would be not allowed, right? Obviously, they're children. Forget about the pachos megil chinuch. Leave that for a moment. But the idea is that it's of benefit. There's a certain hanah, there's a certain goodness, certain enjoyable part of that. There's a lot of versions of that, but let's just go with that. That would be one reason why standing in front of a camera would not be allowed, right? So for example, somebody's asked me, I mean, over the years, people have asked me, knowing that there are cameras inside the shul, can you have the recording that is recording the bar mitzvah boy laning? Can that recording be then delivered to the family as part of like, you know, Rabbi, keep the chumash. I don't want the chumash, my son, right? You don't want the chumash. Keep the chumash. Just give me the recording of my son landing on Shabbos, because I know you have the footage. So you can't give the footage, and you certainly can't rely on that footage, even if I have that footage. But it's interesting, Shaila and Halacha. Let's say you have a Saba and a Safta who missed the bar mitzvah. Are you able to have that? Okay, that's for shoulders far larger than mine. But that's where that's nichale. It's an eventuality. It's a causation that's no question going to be. You know it's going to happen, so therefore it's nichale. Now, in the case of sensors, you don't necessarily know that because you walk here, that the sensor is going to go off, unless you do know. And if you do know, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes in Halicha Shlomo that if there's something called, it's Bederech Halicha, it's the normal way that you go. You don't have to like go around town. You don't have to go now into Boca Grove via Glades, because you know that if you enter the shul area, that it's going to be, you know, start lighting up lights. Now, if you know there's a way to avoid a sensor here and there, ideally, of course, if it's just as well and just as easy, you can. But I'll give you an example where it's the low, where it's the low nichale. It's not in your best interest, and that's why having video cameras is okay on Shabbos, is that nobody wants to be caught on those video cameras unless you're like a teenage kid, unless you're like a little kid who wants to like, you know, have fun on the screen. But if you're a crook, if you're a criminal, and you're breaking in, you're trying to duck from those cameras. You don't want to be caught on those cameras. Those cameras are not where people are going to have hanoi. Those are cameras that are going to hopefully prevent a robber, prevent a thievery. So that's where it's the low nichale. It's psikresha. It's true that he'll be caught on camera, but he doesn't want to. So since he doesn't want to, if you catch him, you're allowed to keep it on. Okay. So here we say that in this situation, Sekevan, since his kavana, his intention is good. He wants to daven kahalacha. He wants to do it as it's supposed to be. But what happens in the middle of his davening? Okay. Even it's not that it's a psikresha. It's not that he starts it knowing that he's going to make a mistake. He starts his davening thinking that he's not going to make a mistake. He thinks that he's not going to be interrupted. He thinks that maybe he's got a grasp on his nerves. He's not going to err. It's not called as a bracha levatala because after all, he didn't plan that. He wasn't intending that. Now, if you knew that you had an illness or you had some circumstance that was going to create that, that's a different conversation. That might be that it's better for you to avoid a situation where you're going to come into the category of Motzei Shem Shemayim Levatela, a bracha levatela, blessing in vain. You don't want that, but it's not in your control. So if it's not in your control, and there's always a possibility, and even if you know that you have an illness, but you don't know if that illness is going to act up, it's going to flare up, that doesn't mean you can never down for the element. It doesn't mean you don't make brachos anymore. It doesn't mean that you now no longer participate with the Jewish people. Chas v'shalom. Says of Ulai al Kalpanim Yesh Lalamdo, at the very least, he says that one should teach this person Demasha Einu Gaimer Bidibor, that what happens in a situation where he would be not able to complete his blessing through recitation, through Dibor, with words, Al Kalpanim Yigmor b'machshava. He can complete it with his machshava. That sentence is like humongous. Such a powerful sentence. Like it's like so new, it's so nuanced. right? This fellow has to be taught. Okay, I guess there exists, maybe this is true, that exists for everybody and anybody, I don't know. That, let's just say a person, he knows that maybe there exists a chance he's going to start a bracha and he's not going to be able to finish the bracha, that he should be taught that whatever he's not able to finish by him actually saying it, you know how he can finish it? He can finish it by his thoughts. That means, Baruch atah Hashem, I'm not able to say Shehakol Nehiyah B'Dvaro, you know, for the case in hand, but I can think Shehakol Nehiyah B'Dvaro, and that's considered a Gemar Bracha. That is such an unbelievable novelty. Now, unfortunately, where that tshuva, this response that can be taken advantage of, obviously, is that people will be doing this all day. Ah, I'm thinking about my tefillin, I'm thinking about my brachos, I'm thinking about Shemoneh Esrei. That's not what it means. It means circumstantially that if you start a bracha, that it can be completed with his machshava, with his thoughts. That's a huge, huge statement. And it has so many different adaptations in such a situation, whether it's a chayli or whether it's a makam mitunaf, it's a dirty, filthy place. You think about something in a place you're not supposed to, or whatever the situation may be. I remember there was a person who was incarcerated who once asked me a shayla when I went to visit that person. They feel that they're given the ability to daven and pray, but they're not able to pray with kavana properly because it's a mukam, it's a dirty, filthy, you know, lessened type of place. So what do you do? So obviously at the time I explained to this person, try to find and tell them if there's a chapel, what have you. That wasn't like they were looking to give this person all these rights. But suffice it to say, this is an interesting tshuva that you could start with saying half the bracha is one way, half the bracha is another way. One foot's in, you know, on the East Coast, one foot's on the West Coast, then Shalom al Yisrael. Anyway, interesting idea. Why? It says, V'kula hai v'ulai. V'kula hai v'ulai is also just like a, it's like a little phrase. It's like in the lexicon of learning, which means v'kula hai v'ulai is just the way you're talking Gemara, which is at least he'll have this. V'kula hai v'ulai, at least he'll have this. Meaning it's not that we say that you have nothing. It's that you have something. And v'kula hai v'ulai means that, okay, you don't have the whole, you know, the whole story the way it's supposed to be, but okay, I'll give you have some credit for something. Now, sometimes in halacha, we don't let it bend that way. We really don't. It's either all or nothing. It's very little that there's gray. The fact that we have our mezuzahs that are placed at a slant, when either it's supposed to be vertical or horizontal, machlekes Rashi Tosfos, is an unusual permissibility of compromise. We rarely have compromise. Rabbi Fran says in one of his books, and one of the reasons why we have that compromise on a mezuzah is because a house should be built with compromise, that he, she, they should be able to hear each other, compromise. A nice little Dvar Torah. Whenever I hang people's mezuzahs, I try to share that little Torah thought. But rarely do we have a situation where this compromise. Person starts out one way, has to conclude another way. There's dibur, there's machshava, that's all in one. We say that, is machshava kedibur dami? Do we say that thought is like dibur, or do we say machshava is lav kedibur dami, which is also a concept in the Gemara. If I think something, it's as it is words. So in this case, it's beneficial. But in other cases in halacha, it's very much not beneficial. How would it be that it's not beneficial, that it's machshava is kedibur dami, that thinking about something is like words? So one of the most popular examples of that is, I can't say that any of us really have this problem, but there are many big rabbanim who did have this problem and do have this problem. What happens if you're in the shirutim and you're in the washer, the bathroom, and you can't stop thinking about Torah learning? You can't stop thinking about something that's an iyun, a sugya, right? Halavai, we should have such problems. You know, they say that the Chazon Ish became so well versed in you know, medicine and medical complicated cases because, I don't know, he would find himself so preoccupied in the Shirutim that he would need to have something to distract himself. They say this is true about the Rambam. I don't know for sure. I just read that one somewhere. But others as well, you need something. Why? Because if you paskin, which is a machlekes haposkim, it's a machlekes in the Gemara, it's a dispute in the Talmud, that if you say is machshava is kedibur dami or machshava is lav kedibur dami, means that if what I think actually the output of that is actually like its words, so it's either good and beneficial in the case that we're studying here this morning, right? The assumption, obviously, this is different because he starts one way and he'll have to conclude another way, or it's very detrimental because if what I'm thinking is everything I'm thinking is manifest and actually counts as words. So that's a big problem. If I'm in the bathroom or if I'm in a place that I'm not supposed to, you know, be thinking something. So what do I do to distract myself? So that's why the invention of a magazine, the invention of a political science book. I don't know. The invention of being able to read something outside of it. Imagine you can't control what you think about. If you're in the world of learning, you're in the bathroom, what should you do? So, okay, so that's one possibility. But here he explains that machshava is lav kedib or dami. That would be one possibility. Here, machshava is kedib or dami. Here it is that it counts. V'chula hai v'ulai means that, okay, at the very least, even though I can't say the blessing the way it's meant to be ideally, so I'm able to do some of it. I said some of it the way it's supposed to be, and I have a machshava as the latter part of it, and that's it. And this is, I love this last sentence. The mitzvah gedola limtso zchus, there's a great mitzvah to try to find merit. You know, people are very, very rigid. People sometimes find that black and white are the borders that they live within all the time. But limsa zechus lahafach b'schus talmidei chachamim, the righteous, wise sages are able to try to find ways and wherewithal for people to fulfill mitzvos. Right? It's true, it might not be the ideal way to do it, but let's just do it. Let's just figure out a way to do it. Now, obviously, you run the risk that if you teach somebody not the right way to do it, that that's going to be ensconced as to how they're always going to do it. Maybe a person who was given once a halachic dispensation to be maschil b'dibur or messiah b'machshava is going to take that all the way to the bank and say, oh, in every situation, I can be maschil b'dibur and be messiah b'machshava. No, that's obviously not allowed. Obviously, it's circumstantially. In a situation of pressing need, there are obviously halachic circumstances where there are permissibilities that are unique to the situation that they're in, but they're not meant for longevity. They're meant for just circumstances. So that's interesting. As Talmidei Chachamim, as Rabbanim, as people who are, you know, whether no matter what your field of discipline is, to try to be able to get it to people that they should do something, just something, and that something will lead to something else eventually, is what it is. And that's, he says, is mitzvah gedola. That is a great mitzvah for people to be able to limsos chos lahafach b'schus talmidei chachamim, that the ones who are able to find a way for people to be able to fulfill mitzvahs as best they can. And that's one example. B'dibor is the haschala, is the beginning, and machshav is the seifa, is the end, is the conclusion. And tzizamen, you put them together, there you go, you have a bracha. Interesting idea. What do you think about that before we get to the last paragraph? Any questions, comments, concerns to that?
I have a question. So clearly there are people who grow up and they are stutterers, and some people benefit from intervention and other people don't benefit from it. But let's say, I'll just say something like a bar mitzvah kid wants to have his aliyah, and then he goes up and he's practice, but then there's a situation. So you've taught him, okay, well, if you can't finish the bracha, okay, then you'll just say it in your head kind of idea. But now, do we worry that the rest of the congregation is going to be like, what is going on here, and think ill of him? Like, what do you do about that? And what if, let's say, he has practiced with you and you know ahead of time, oh, he's good to go, but then at that moment, things sort of fall apart. Like,
yeah,
how do you treat that?
Yeah, it's a hard case. I will tell you just from experience, we had a case like that a few years ago. This is the exact case. Uh-huh. It's probably going on, I would say probably now, it's probably like 7 years ago, 6-7 years ago. And there was a bar mitzvah boy who had a very, very intense stutter, very, very intense. Mm-hmm. It was tremendous angst and anxiety for his parents. They were very, very nervous. And, you know, when I would practice with him, you know, I spent a lot of time with him. He had it because the stuttering was really, really brought to fruition because of the nerves and anxiety. Obviously, I'm sure physiologically there's a lot of triggers. But so for this kid, whenever he was around anybody more than the people that he trusted, in fact, his parents wanted me to spend more time with him so he'd feel that, which actually ended up happening. He would look at me, because looking at his parents was obviously something that calmed him. But he would look, he needed other stimuli, people to look at that would bring him to calm him down. I'm sure Linda, you remember this case, but he said he would actually look at me, and I was like, I stood at a certain spot that he should look at me and he should be, you know, calm himself down. Now, two things happened. The first thing is he did do an abbreviated laning just his parents felt that it was like a little too much for him to do, like the preparation was. He did an abbreviated laning, and I could say this is that, sure, was there a concern? Was there a worry that the people would feel unsettled? What's going on here? It would add to it. There's no question about it. You know, for example, the Mishnayos in Maseches Yuma, in the in the latter sections of Maseches, the first chapter of Maseches Yuma, and the beginning of Maseches Yuma, and various other places, and the Gemara Megillah, I should say also, the Gemara explains, who is allowed to duchen? Are all Kohanim allowed to duchen, right? So there are a lot of different examples of which Kohanim are not allowed to duchen. One example is, let's just say a Kohen, it's an unusual case, but let's say a Kohen has dyed, D-Y-E, dyed hands, and he would lift his hands to duchen, so that person, that Kohen, is not allowed to duchen, al pi halacha. Why? And the answer is because people are going to look at him, and they're going to stare at him, and they're not supposed to look, and it's going to, whatever it's going to be. Now, the exception to that is if he comes from a town where everybody's a dyer. That is the profession of the town, right? Like the steel city. The steel city is, they all deal with steel, right? Pittsburgh. So, right. So in that case, sure, you're worried about people looking. You're worried about people staring. So I don't want to overlook that and not state that. In halacha, there is a concern that people are going to look and stare, and therefore there's a change in the halacha. In the halacha, if a person is, it looks different, there is a certain consideration in the case of birchas kohanim. Good. In this case, sure, I was also a little bit anxious that the people would maybe be insensitive. They'd be a little bit growing impatient. You know how people are. People can be very tough. But I also felt there's a concept that I think becomes overlooked that is far more necessary than we give attention to. And that is being hevidanis kol adam l'chavschus, which means giving people the benefit of the doubt. And that doesn't just mean giving people the benefit of the doubt about things that you don't see the whole story. You should assume the end of the story is positive. That's for sure what it means. But being down l'chavschus means like a little bit of compassion, a little bit of mercy, a little bit of like sensitivity. So I was actually, as much as I was celebrating the boys' bar mitzvah that Shabbos, I was also celebrating what I was hoping was going to be, which ended up being a community that's just going to be able to handle it. And they were going to be able to like read the story, see the situation. Listen, if it would have been a whole long parsha, if it would have been Parshas Vayakel B'Kudei and Parshas Chodesh, I think it would have been a little bit too hard for the family. And it just, and the family understood the challenges, and they just made it possible for the boys, so he didn't have to read more than he could read. But yeah, the community was, you know, I did whisper to a couple of the gabbayim, obviously, that there should be a sensitivity, and I was very proud that most people, I mean, I didn't hear from one person that Shabbos, and it's good that I didn't, because I would have been so highly impatient if somebody would have complained about somebody who has a situation. The community was soared with flying colors, and they understood, you know, they got to the Kiddush about 10 or 15 minutes later, and they were, got home a little bit later, and they handled it. And that's what it is. So sure. I will tell you this, and this is obviously something that can be continually changed. And it's amazing how people, how there's so much to know and so much to trust, even though sometimes there's things you just don't know. So I could tell you that in the after, I should say before that. So we've all been to shuls before where a bar mitzvah boy, bat mitzvah girl, they speak in the shul, right? You've seen that happen where they get up and they give their Dvar Torah in shul. So right. we've done that obviously over the years, but actually I stopped it. I should say I put it on hiatus. And the reason why I stopped and put it on hiatus was in the area and the time when this boy was becoming bar mitzvah. Because he had about four or five friends in the shul who were also being bar mitzvah, and they were going to get up and they were going to say a big pshetel, a big dvar Torah in shul, and this boy, there was no chance he was going to be able to look at the synagogue and look at the people and do that. And I didn't want him to. It was such a monumental feat for him to be able to lane it all that I felt like it's not necessary for the bar mitzvah boy to speak in front of the shul. And even though it might be that he's okay missing an opportunity, a rite of passage, I thought that rite of passage, it's a lesson that's more important to learn. They'll speak at the family meals and, you know, I'll attend and I'll be there, whatever it will be. And that's kind of like what happened. So I'm not opposed to obviously that situation, but a mitzvah boy will speak, you know, if the parents are very, very, very headstrong about making that happen. I don't answer it, but I do remind parents that not everybody has children that are not only capable, but are comfortable to be able to do it. So you should be sensitive to the ones who are not. It puts an unduly amount of pressure on kids that either have cases like this where they have a stutter or they have other anxiety issues or just not able to do it. And it's just more embarrassment than it is goodness. Whereas I find that when the kids speak at the family meals, they're around more familiar people. It's not as not as stressful, and it's actually far more meaningful. So when I'm able to be successful and telling people to do that, they usually do that. You know, people have said to me, Rabbi, why don't you have the bar mitzvah boys, bar mitzvah girls speak in the shul? But they have to understand there's always a backstory. And the backstory is because I could not let this boy be embarrassed. And he was not going to do it, and it was just going to further his embarrassment if he would be the only one in that group that wasn't going to do it. Now, obviously, these can be revisited over time, but I happen to think that I've seen, even when kids don't have such a severity, like a stutter like that, I think that there's a sensitivity. But, you know, there's what to be said. It's true. The congregation might be a little antsy. It's okay. It's all right. I don't know. I find that it's good for them to learn it a little bit sometimes.
I have a question for you, another one, which is if you're going to be making halachic decisions based on machshava, on your intentions, in this case, I understand the person has physical limitations. I understand the person is sick, maybe. But what about, why wouldn't it apply to anything? Why wouldn't it apply to a person who doesn't know how to read Hebrew well, who doesn't, anybody who gets up to be about tefillah, you assume the guy has good intentions. So it's easier to understand if a person is ill, but why wouldn't it apply to anybody who, you know, like your second cousin 15th removed, who consistently gets it that way? It's okay.
Right. So that's where we need this last paragraph. This last paragraph is there's a difference between psik resha and not, which means if you have good intentions and all things being equal, you know how to do it, and there's no reason to suspect without stimuli that gets you triggered that you're going to do it okay, even though you're very nervous, then it's okay to start because your good intentions and the machshava is going to count for you. You can pull it from your rucksack and you're going to be able to complete it. But if you know merosh that you're not going to be able to, or there's a high, high, super regular likelihood that that's not going to be okay, meaning the second cousin 15 times removed, I feel bad for this person. I really do. But I don't necessarily disagree. I hope that they're going to be able to get the confidence and be in like a smaller situation that's going to build their confidence in themselves to be able to do it. But if you know that you're going to make a mistake time and time again, every single time, you're people that just suffer from dyslexia. They're people that just, they're reading something and what they read and what they pronounce and what they see and what they say, they don't align, right? But that's what he says in this final paragraph. And I'll just read this last paragraph because I think it answers your question. V'sha'alti, he explains, he asks questions to Rabbi Eliashiv, im zelo psikresha, then he becomes silent. If it's not a psikresha, then it's mutar l'haschil l'varech. If it's not a psikresha, which is not obvious that it's going to happen, then it's permissible that he can make that bracha. Sh'arechai b'tfila b'rchus v'hu menas l'kayim chavasu mutalo, that it's permissible that he can. V'ein b'zeh b'zayin v'zulosu klapi shmaya, which means he ends this by saying that if it's not a psik resha, if it's not obvious, fine, you can do it. And he has an obligation to daven like everybody else. But if it is a psik resha, and one of the cases I'm thinking about is the guy who doesn't really know how to daven. His whole davening, his whole life, if he's even davened as much, his whole life is, he says, Asher Yishrei Beisecha. Count, wait. Hilas Hashem Yidav Rapi. He doesn't say the paragraph in between, right? He just says the words that he knows, and he doesn't even know all of the Shemoneh Esrei. He doesn't know all the words of davening. And now he has whatever the reason, unfortunately he's a mourner, he has whatever reason now he has the feeling that he's going to daven for the Am, but he doesn't really know how to daven. He feels an obligation to do it, and he's going to do whatever he needs to do to get there, but he doesn't really know how to do it. So that person needs to be trained really before he can do it. And machshava, good intentions, isn't enough. The right reason isn't enough. If you know for sure you're going to make a mistake, or in all likelihood you're going to make a mistake because you've never learned how to do it, so then it's not okay. Then it's not allowed. Where it's unexpected, or even if it's known that you have an ailment, the physiological reality that's going to create circumstances, going to make an error, you can start because we don't know for sure that it's going to be that this person is going to go into stutter mode or epileptic, episode and things of that sort. But it's true. What you're suggesting is also correct. There's a dangerous slippery slope and thinking about where machshava can now play an integral part of it. Sure, it can. That's the machlokas in the Rishonim, whether you say machshava is kadib or dami or machshava is lav kadib or dami. Many Rishonim say that it's a very dangerous thing, and machshava is, you have to say that it's lav kedibur dami, and therefore if it doesn't work, then good. Better to say that it doesn't work than to have situations where it can be applied where it can work. That's a concept in halacha which we call a low plug. Low plug means that, okay, technically speaking, it could be fulfilled in other ways, but in order to not complicate matters by saying the people are complicated and the levels and the vicissitudes of people's levels of learning is so erratic that it's better for a person to say, low plug, let's just make it this way. One of the examples of that is Shema at night, right? We have an obligation to say Kriya Shema, three paragraphs of the Shema, both during the day and at night, the second time after Tzeis HaKochavim, after three medium-sized stars. Now, that's the reason why we say we daven Ma'ariv, actually. And we put the Kriya Shema, which is Daraisa, into the Ma'ariv, which is Derabanan. Somebody could argue, which we could open Mishnah Berurah and rip into this question together. Mishnah Berurah said, I understand. If it's Derabanan, so I don't have to daven Ma'ariv, I just have to say Shema. Answers, the rabbi said, it's a low plug. Let's just make everybody obligated to daven Ma'ariv. You're at shul already. And then by definition, we're going to say that this should then facilitate your fulfillment of the biblical obligation. We have a lot of different examples of that. A low plug. Bedikas chametz or beer chametz, achilas chametz. What is the whole idea of 5 hours of the day and 4 hours a day? Everybody knows on Erev Pesach. People don't necessarily know the reasons why, but we're all familiar that the last time you can eat chametz is 10:12 a.m. Right? Last time to burn the chametz is 12:15. My kids, they don't know these, not round numbers except for this time of year. Right? So 10:12, like, oh, when's 10:12? When's the last bite of my bagel? When's the last bowl of Fruity Pebbles? Right? What's that? Why should that matter? I just can't eat chametz on Pesach. The Rabbanan made a geder, they made a protective fence because the concept of a low plug. So you're asking, and therefore I know that if I make a protective fence and I say that it's prohibited even earlier, no one's going to then touch the dangerous place called spiritual excision called kares, like eating chametz on Pesach, even inadvertently, and therefore be in the burn of the fire. Nobody wants that. You're right. It's definitely a little bit of a dangerous and a slippery slope. And certainly with outreach and kiruv and things of that sort, machshava is huge. Here's the struggles. You're telling people to constantly have good machshavas and think properly and have good kavana, and it works and it works and it works. But we don't want it to work too much, because if it works too much, then you're going to just lay in bed all day and like say brachas and daven and eat matzah and keep Pesach and, without doing it. It's the combustion, it's the synergy of the machshava and the asiya. That's a good topic for a good drush one time. Like the machshava and the asiya, what you think and what you do, the actions and the thoughts. But that's really the tefillin shel rosh is on the moch, on the mind and on the intellect and the which is supposed to facilitate what you intellectually know, and the tefillin shel yad is opposite the heart, which is the emotional, the feeling, the regesh, and one brings about the other. It's a good question, though. Anybody else? Yes, Doc.
If I can amplify on that, if somebody has a physical or even an emotional impairment that is preventing them from, interferes with their davening, I would be the most lenient person on earth with the bar mitzvah boy or whoever it is. Sure. But we do have some people who they're just sloppy. And they get up, they daven fire moment. You can't understand what they're saying. And their intentions may be good, but because the obligation is on there are two parties here. There's a person who's making the bracha, and there's a person who's hearing the bracha and hearing the Megillah or whatever it is. And there's a heightened responsibility for that individual to make sure that it's not just, I thought I said it right. You didn't. Somebody has to be able to say to that person. Now, I'm not advocating that people, shout out and correct like I've seen in many shuls. But I think the leadership of the shul has to approach that individual and let him know that this is not right. And we can work with you. We want you to daven fire on it, but you got to do it right so that everybody fulfills a mitzvah.
Yeah. It's tough. Yeah. I know personally, I work as much as I can to try to myself tutor them. I've actually hired tutors for them, and sometimes it works, and sometimes it works for a short period of time, and sometimes it stops working. It's tough. It's a tough thing, but you're 100% right. The difference between, listen, there's no question about it. You're standing in line at the grocery store and for a baby's crying in the carriage in front of you. It's annoying, but it's a baby. That's what babies do. Or an elderly gentleman cuts you off in line. And you're like, just as the ire is like just burning inside you, they like lift their arm, you see numbers tattooed to their arms. They're like, ah, okay, nope, a little rachmanis, right? And then you see like a 45-year-old whippersnapper. He like cuts you off in line. He starts crying. He starts carrying on. You're like, this guy's a maneuver. You're calling like, you know, give me the superintendent. Get this trash out of here. You know, like rightfully, we expect people who should know better. Just being sloppy is like unfair to the people. If a person has a circumstance and a situation, we're all hopefully sensitive enough to be, you know, kind and generous and forgiving and welcoming and supportive, all of those things. But 100%, Rabbi Gabayim, leadership of the shul, always have to figure out how to do that. And listen, you know, that's easier said than done, but that doesn't mean that the obligation is an exemption. The obligation is a chiyuv. It's an obligation that's strong. I make recordings for people. I mean, like I literally do, and sometimes I see it works, and sometimes it works less, and sometimes it works more, and sometimes, you know, it's tough. It's tough, but point well taken. Point very well taken. All right, so good. In this small little tshuva, we got a lot of different terms, a lot of Gemara terms, a lot of different ideas, Shomea Ka'one among them, and various other points, Machshava Kedibur Dami, Machshava Lav Kedibur Dami. Interesting cases. If you want to look in Shulchan Aruch and Simon Mem Beis, it also has a whole long discussion about whether you say Brachos and Birchas HaTorah could be in your Machshava or not. That's some side reading. If the rest of your Monday feels cloudy and rainy and you just want to stay off the golf course and stay off the tennis courts and no pickleball for anybody, Simon Mendes. Wishing everybody a wonderful day. Okay. Thank you so much, David, for your generosity and
sponsorship. Thank you.
For your dear father.